Испанская полиция выдала ордер на арест нескольких россиян,
связанных с преступной группировкой Геннадия Петрова, известного уголовного авторитета.
Замдиректора ФСКН Николай Аулов и депутат Госдумы.
Владислав Резник с женой.
Бывший коллега Владимира Путина по ленинградскому КГБ Николай Аулов.
А также члена Малышевской группировки Леонида Христофорова.
Another shoe drops, another mask is removed, another set of skeletons walk out of Владимир Путин's closet. Another international investigation exposes the dark heart of the Kremlin regime. A Spanish judge this week issued international arrest warrants for a dozen Russians, including current and former officials, in connection with a decade-long organized crime investigation. The Spanish probe into the Tambov and Malyshev gangs has shown a bright spotlight on Putin's mob ties, dating back to his tenure as deputy mayor of the gangster paradise of St. Petersburg in the 1990s. But is it a sign that Western governments are getting serious about confronting Putin's kleptocracy? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russia's organized crime and security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome to Prague, Mark.
Good to be here in person.
Good to have you here in person. Also joining us via Skype from Oxford, Ohio, is Karen Dawisha, director of the Havergers Center for Russian and Post-Soviet Studies at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, and author of the highly acclaimed book, Putin's Kleptocracy, Who Owns Russia? Welcome back, Karen.
Thanks, Brian.
So, among the figures on Judge Jose de la Mata's wanted list are Interior Ministry official Nikolai Olev, who is the deputy head of the Federal Anti-Narcotics Service, Vladislav Reznik, a member of the ruling United Russian Party, who is deputy head of the State Duma's Finance Committee, and Igor Sobolevsky, the former deputy head of the Investigative Committee. Other officials noted in the report, but not subject to warrants, included two longtime Putin confidants, former Prime Minister Viktor Zubkov and current Deputy Prime Minister Dmitry Kozak. Also named are former Defense Minister Anatoly Serdyukov and former Information Technology Minister Leonid Reisman. Briefing American officials about this case back in 2010, Spanish prosecutor Jose Grinda said the Kremlin uses organized crime groups to do whatever the government of Russia cannot acceptably do as a government. He called Russia a, quote, virtual mafia state, and I'm quoting here because I know you both hate that phrase, where the activities of the government and organized crime are indistinguishable. Mark, in a piece for the European Council on Foreign Relations that was just published this week, you wrote that tackling the Russian organized crime issue is a task that should be handled at a coordinated at the EU level in a coordinated fashion. Why, and do you see this happening anytime soon?
Well, let's start with the why. I mean, when it comes down to it, this is, after all, not a Spanish government initiative, but a Spanish courts initiative, which, after all, Spain is not like Russia. The courts actually are independent. And it's as yet hard to tell, even if, frankly, the Spanish government is especially enthusiastic about what its judges are doing. Because when it comes down to it, I mean, this is a really interesting example of Spanish law and Spanish investigations against organized crime beginning to extend further and further into the kind of the corruption and kleptocratic connections, which in a way cradle and facilitate organized crime. And that's a really interesting sort of way of attacking this problem. But if it's just one case, or even if it's just one country within, say, the European Union, what we end up doing is we're just squeezing the balloon. Already, I think Russian gangsters have realized that Spain, which in the late 90s and early noughts was seen as a very sort of congenial, both because of the climate, but law enforcement target, for them, have already realized that actually Spain no longer is. And therefore, they're looking at other places, including, for example, France, which, after all, shares much of the climate in every sense of the word. So if we do that, of course, it's worth doing. But in the grand scheme of things, it just simply moves the problem around, which is why I think I'd like to see it handled on a coordinated level. Is it going to happen? No. I'm not saying never, but at the moment, unfortunately, we're not really seeing any signs. I think there's two separate issues here. One is a willingness by individual countries to accept what might seem to be short-term costs to them. that their financial system will not benefit from all this Russian money sloshing through, and their lawyers won't be getting all these lovely fat fees and everything else. But the second issue is a disinclination to get involved in basically using the law against what is ultimately a core element of the Russian state structure. Because then we actually get into, unfortunately, what precisely Investigations Committee Bastrykin talked about law being weaponized. Well, I mean, again, I'm not saying I have a problem with that, but in fact, we are then seeing the law begin to be used against the Russian state.
But isn't that how a criminal group would look at law enforcement? I mean, I make this point in the Morning Vertical today. It's completely predictable for me that Russia's going to look at the West exercising its sovereign right to enforce its own laws as a threat, as an act of war, as an act of lawfare, if you will. But if this is a threat to the West, what else can the West do enforce its own laws?
I'm not for a minute saying that they shouldn't do this. I think absolutely. I mean, we just simply have to be honest with ourselves that actually as we seek to enforce our laws and it begins to affect people who are within Russia and the systems by which they rule, just as when we support anti-corruption NGOs or honest journalists doing investigative work or whatever, things that we do because we think they're right, these are also things which precisely impact the Russian system of rule. So it is lawfare. Mm. That doesn't mean to say we shouldn't be doing it.
Right. But you don't see it happening because people are going to be squeamish about the fact that this is going to touch some poor
interests?
I think
so, because then this is a problem. It needs to have, I mean, obviously individual countries can do things, regional groups can do things, but really to do it properly, it needs to be coordinated and regional across Europe. And I'm not seeing at the moment, and things may change, and I hope I'm completely wrong with this, but I'm not seeing any enthusiasm for that.
I mean, I have to wonder when people are going to start viewing this as a national security issue, because, again, to use another word I know you don't like, Russia's weaponized its mafias. Right?
Well, I mean, I'll be honest. I mean, I think the impact of Russian organized crime across Europe and the West is almost entirely about the criminal stuff they do. The elements in which actually the Russian state specifically reaches in and uses them is relatively small scale and marginal and very, very specific. So it's not that I see this, as it were, weaponized as part of some kind of Russian ploy against the West. It's rather that just simply it is a toxic and infectious force, which absolutely is a national security issue. I mean, all kinds of things can be national security issues, from pandemics to migration concerns, without anyone actually being behind them. But yes, I mean, in the West, we need to get serious about this. We do need to appreciate that that is what's going on.
Karen, anything to add to this? And also, you've been investigating these issues for a long time. Anything in this week's indictments that surprised you or jumped out at you?
Well, it was a great pleasure to see so many of my old research buddies showing up.
Do you feel vindicated?
Well, you know, one doesn't always seek to be vindicated in those terms. I would much rather have had this, have gone to court in 2008 when Petrov and his group were first identified. But now we have the listing of quite a number of people who are directly connected to top Russian, senior Russian government officials, as the State Department might call the situation. Not just Aulov, but Sobolevsky.
Right.
Sobolevsky is the ex-deputy to Bastrykin,
right,
as the head of the investigative committee, who was quietly fired by Medvedev in 2008. Bastrykin himself is mentioned in the wiretaps. It's quite clear that Petrov felt, the head of the Tambov Mafia, felt that he had great influence in getting Bastrykin appointed as head of the investigative committee. Serdyukov, Fradkov, both referring to and referred to as in some ways reporting to Petrov, as junior to Petrov, as depending upon Petrov for influence at the highest levels to get themselves appointed. So this is not just a matter of what we learn about, you know, the small matters of money laundering, murder, fraud, cocaine dealing, capturing of officials in Europe and elsewhere. It's a pretty great document for exploring the extent to which the Russian government itself and senior members of the St. Petersburg mafias are coordinating some of their actions. Mm-hmm. You know, just adding to something that Mark said when he expressed dismay about your evidently very naive statement that Europe might respond in a coordinated way, and you know his excellent article on this. Well, I think a lot of this is also coming out of American pressure, and we shouldn't underestimate the impact of Interpol in all of this. All of these countries are signatories to Interpol, and so now when you have arrest warrants issued, this is now going to Interpol, and it will. And I was listening just this morning to a great conversation on Radio Svoboda about this with Russian-based journalists, some of them Spanish, about what's going to happen. And it, you know, people in St. Petersburg, including Petrov, who was interviewed mm-hmm. on Russian media yesterday.
Yeah, he was, I know.
Very available and openly living.
Well, he's just a respectable businessman, after all.
Yeah, that's right. Complaining that, you know, people aren't able to even cross borders anymore. They're scared that they're going to be arrested. And we have the happy case of Victor Boot,
right,
who was very, very aggressively captured, if we can mm-hmm. say this, by American authorities and brought back to the United States and is sitting in a federal prison. I think that this is really what they're concerned about. You know, so we have people who've been able to move around Europe, many of whom have European passports, are not going to be able to use those passports mm-hmm. for free access to European states, or as Petrov complained, evidently, according to Radio Svoboda, people can't even go to Vietnam anymore. I mean, what is the world coming to?
When you're a gangster and you can't go to Vietnam, what is the world coming to? Mark, anything to add here?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, to paraphrase Trotsky, you may not be interested in globalization, but globalization is interested in you. I mean, I think this is precisely the case, that for so long, a Russian elite that does sort of blur between the realms of politics, business, and crime has been the enthusiastic beneficiary of all these opportunities, moving their money around so that it's in sort of safer jurisdiction, safer being actually out of the hands of the Russian state rather than anyone else's, enjoying the opportunities to live in agreeable climes, to buy properties in London, to send their kids to university abroad, all these kinds of things. They have enthusiastically and aggressively enjoyed that while relying on, as it were, their base of Russia and its distinctive and characteristic approach to the law-based state to protect themselves from that. Well, now they're suddenly finding that they can't live in both worlds. Now, realistically, since I don't think we're, you know, and rightly, we're not going to get into the realms of trying for sort of regime change in Russia or anything like that, realistically, Russia will have to work out its own domestic problems. What we can do is squeeze back and squeeze back and make it clear not only that as it were, the Russian way of doing things has to stay within Russia's borders, but also that people are going to have to find themselves making choices. If you want all the perks of being a European, you actually have to cope also with the responsibilities rules. And the rules.
Right. You know, I mean, this gets into this whole lawfare issue that we talked about a little bit, and I wanted to talk more about this because in your piece for ECFR, Mark, you said that corruption, trading of favors, embezzlement, favoritism are not just endemic in Russia, but part of the kleptocratic system of rule through which Vladimir Putin controls his elites. Given this understanding, do such campaigns start as law enforcement and end up, intentionally or not, as foreign campaigns aimed at regime change? Now, I mean, I don't think the intention here is regime change at all. I think the West is simply trying to enforce its own laws. I think these Spanish judges and prosecutors are earnestly trying to enforce their own laws. I think the British investigators who did the Litvinenko inquiry were honestly trying to get the bottom of a crime that was committed in the heart of London. So on the other hand, we're talking here about assassinations, weapons trafficking, extortion, fraud, forgery, bribery, drug smuggling, and money laundering. What else can the West do but enforce its own laws? And how do you deal with a state that has nationalized this kind of behavior?
Well, no, exactly. I mean, remember, I am not here saying that the Europeans ought not to be enforcing their laws. All I'm saying is that I think we have had something of a rather flabby unwillingness to appreciate the situation. The fact of the matter is that now, whatever the talk of sovereignty may be, unless maybe you're, you know, some kind of peasant in North Korea, you are part also of global and wider communities. Everybody is. And in some ways, the richer and more powerful you are, the more so you are. So that actually we live in an age of blended sovereignties. And therefore, absolutely, as we in Europe, or indeed in North America, impose and assert our laws and say, no, these things are not acceptable. And what's more, we are willing to do so in a way that says, well, look, we will at the very least say this person may not be in our country, but we have the phone taps, we have the other evidence to see how they connect with criminal activities that took place within our country, which is what's going on in this case. As we do that, we are not just asserting our own laws, we are doing something that is destabilizing of a corrupt and criminalized other state. Again, this does not mean let's not do it. I'm just simply saying let's just be clear that that's what we are doing.
That's the effect of what we are doing.
Yeah. Right.
Karen, what would you add to this? Is it possible to squeeze this all back inside of Russia's borders? Because we have now a situation. I've brought this up in the past. I mean, comparing the situation to the old Cold War. You had a system that was completely contrary to our values, but it was contained. It didn't penetrate our system. Now we have that, and it's embedded in our systems as well and is corrupting our systems. Is kind of legal containment possible? Because I prefer the term legal containment to lawfare, because I don't see this as warfare. I see it as trying to push back this corrupt activity out of our system, and what happens inside Russia is for the Russians to decide.
Well, I've written a lot about this. I think what's fundamentally happened in Russia is that what we would have expected from Russia coming out of the 90s was that, you know, the growing middle class, the business owners would gain an interest, an embedded interest in secure property rights. That's what democratization theory tells us. So what happened in Russia? They got the rule of law. They got it. They got it in London.
Right.
So globalization allowed them to move the money. And this is not just the mafia. This is
everybody. You know, everybody that has money.
$150 billion a year is not just the mafia. It allowed them to move the money out and secure their property rights in other countries while continuing to predate and raid with impunity. And that's the role of the state, if you were close to Putin, with impunity inside Russia. So when you talk about squeezing all of this back into Russia, what we're talking about is under what circumstances would Russian elites in fact de-offshoreize, which Putin talks about a lot.
Putin says he wants this, yeah.
Right?
I don't believe him, but he says he wants it.
The big problem is that he wants the de-offshoreization of that money that he hasn't entirely controlled, but he doesn't want the offshoreization of all money. And the mafia is able in such circumstances to charge a higher rate for the illicit moving of money from the state budget outside of Russia. Mm-hmm. It becomes a tax, they charge more. So money continues to come out. In fact, the biggest spike in the capital flight was not in the 90s, not in the 2000s. It was the year in which sanctions were imposed. Mm-hmm. It was 2014. That was the single biggest year of growth in capital flight out of Russia. But I suspect that it cost more. Mm-hmm. It cost more. And the mafia really cleaned up. Now, squeezing it back, I think the rule of law is something all Western states have an implicit interest in, because without enforcing it on their own territory, there's no such thing as sovereign rights. And we could do worse in the United States than in imposing it first in our country. So Interpol and Department of Justice chasing of the Russian mafia in Spain is all fine and well. But unless, if we look, just looking at the list that was produced yesterday, something is done about Diana or Diana Ginden, mm-hmm. and who has an American passport as well as a Russian passport, who is the wife of Resnick. Mm-hmm. Forget Resnick. Let's talk about the wife, who was the head of Credit Suisse Bank of Boston in Russia, and who also went back and forth to Spain as somebody who was dealing with their accounts. I mean, she owns the top floor, according to property records that are available if anybody does the work, the top floor of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Miami Beach. Mm. So what is the Department of Justice doing about that?
That's a good question. I'd like to know, actually.
So people should really look at who's got the apartments in Trump Towers, who is owning the individual apartments in the three tower blocks in Miami Beach, mainly owned by Colombian and Russian elites at the dead end of Hallandale Avenue in Miami Beach. Let's focus. Let's everybody focus on our own jurisdictions and see if we can clean them up. And then we'll all collectively be in a much better situation to say that this isn't just about politics. This is actually a serious effort to enforce our own commitments to rule of law. Mm.
And solve a national security problem in the process. Mark, I can't help it. We're not going to get too far without talking about Vostrykin with you here, because he's your favorite subject. Karen raised the issue of Sobolevsky was the deputy of Alexander Vostrykin at the investigative committee. And Aulov was the deputy of Viktor Ivanov at the Federal Anti-Narcotics Office. So this is suggesting that we're getting people really close to Putin that were mobbed up. Is Vostrykin mobbed up? Do you have any?
Well, come now. This is the point where I obviously have to be depressingly pedantic, because that is my role. When you say mobbed up, I mean, this is for me one of the fascinating things about this particular case and why it's really important, is because it shows the definitional problems. Because mm-hmm. we have people who are, I think we can very definitely say, these are gangsters. Then there are people like Petrov who are clearly gangsters and business people. I mean, they who actually have entirely legitimate interests that aren't just simply money laundering fronts or whatever. You know, these are people who don't care whether it's legal or illegal, just as long as it makes money. And then you actually have, in continuing sort of expanding concentric circles, people within officialdom who do favors, who receive favors, who may take money, but more often than not, it's about blood. It's about pull and favoritism mm-hmm. and everything else. And I think that the issue for me is because it takes away this nice binary division of good and bad, of mobbed up and honest. What it actually says to me is this is an elite in which basically nobody is honest. We're just talking about shades of grey. So when you look at people like Sobolevsky and so forth, they clearly are darker grey, mm-hmm. substantially so. But the point is everyone is connected with everyone else. I mean, the very fact that actually the sort of the wider discussions about the people involved, once it starts getting in people like Zubkov and so forth, it begins to become essentially a caste of the entire senior Russian elite.
Yeah.
But that's because exactly everyone is involved in these processes. So really, we're all just trying to identify where they fit on the spectrum. So having made that tediously lengthy sort of definitional mm-hmm. point, I mean, when we look at Vostrykin...
I provoked you with that on purpose.
Of course,
I used mobbed up on purpose because I knew it would get you going.
He says. and I think I came all the way here and got through security. But look, when you look at someone like Vostrykin, I mean, it's clear this is someone who is, A, exceedingly ambitious, and B, has never had any real natural support base. He's got, I mean, I hesitate to make you feel sorry for him, he's got no friends in the political sense.
Gee, I can't imagine why.
You know, he's very much, he's had to fight against a whole variety of structures to get where he's at. Now, you don't do that just simply by being brilliant. I mean, he's not a stupid guy.
Right.
But that is no way enough. He actually managed to, come on, create an entire new structure for him to lead when he ripped the investigations committee out of the Prosecutor General's office. Yeah. Now, to do that, you have to make other deals. There have to be other ways that you get it. And I think this is it. I mean, I think it's clear that Bastrykin is interested primarily in politics and the policing of political crime. Both, I think, because of his natural inclinations. He's clearly an authoritarian statist at heart. But also because he knows that's what plays with the Kremlin. The Kremlin isn't interested in someone saying, look, I've managed to put a whole bunch of nasty gangsters in jail. That's never been something that really plays well with them. But on the other hand, one dissident, that, on the other hand, is a chance to break out the Crimean champagne. So I think this is it. I mean, I think as someone who is both ambitious and doesn't have a power base to go with that, and is also interested in developing a career as a professional political inquisitor, this is clearly someone who is probably perfectly willing to see deals being cut with gangsters,
right,
as long as there's no serious political cost. And dealing with Tambovskaya, on the whole, there was no political cost.
At least one part of Tambovskaya.
So again, I mean, to give the short answer to your question, you know, is he filthy? I don't know about that. But is he at least mildly grubby? Definitely.
Now, Karen seemed to suggest that Petrov was basically facilitating appointments of people like Bastrykin. I mean, what's the tail and what's the dog here?
Well, I mean, this is Russia. It's all tail and all dog. I mean, I think when it comes down to it, I mean, let me put it this way. I would very much doubt, even if Petrov thinks that he's a kind of a senior partner to people like Bastrykin or Tharkov, I don't believe that for a minute, but it may well be that's what he says, or even that's what he believes. I mean, he has a certain weight monetarily and politically, and clearly, you know, some of that weight can be, if I can sort of mix my metaphors, spent. You know, capital can be spent on getting people promotions in return for favors.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he clearly is, in that respect, a broker of political capital.
Mm-hmm. Another interesting thing before we move on to the second half I wanted to touch on is that the name Vladimir Kumarin, or Barsukov, if you like, I was curious about, in these documents, what light was shed on the whole decision to take Kumarin down back in 2007. Vladimir Kumarin, of course, being the founding leader of the Tambovskaya Grupirovka in St. Petersburg, somebody who did a lot of business with Vladimir Putin when Putin was deputy mayor of St. Petersburg. Putin helped Kumarin and Tambovskaya Grupirovka get control of the city's gaming industry, of the ports, of the fuel distribution network, and so on. Karen, you outlined this very extensively in your book. I was in Petersburg as it was happening in real time. I didn't have access to your information then. I sure as hell wish I did. But Kumarin basically was the top dog in Petersburg. I would argue he was more powerful than Putin in the 90s in Petersburg. I would make that argument. Karen, I know you disagree with that, but I would make that argument that he was the man. Now, this he managed to keep his position into 2007 and then was very abruptly, in my opinion, very surprisingly taken down. Now, what these documents revealed was that Aulov was the key figure in this. Karen, what does that tell you? I'm just, what light does this all shed on Kumarin in his role?
Well,
you're smiling. You got something good up your sleeve.
No, I think that it reveals that there's no honor amongst thieves.
That's not a revelation.
that Petrov happily resided in Spain and ran Kremlin money, and Kumarin got arrested. And it's clear that Petrov regards himself as not only the winner, but the responsible one who helped make that happen, that the final debt that Kumarin owned Petrov for years of competition was paid. And, you know, these guys were in competition. The state authorities helped, you know, the ultimate balancer, if we can call Putin that, balance between them in Petersburg.
Yeah.
And allowed ultimately Petrov to emerge as the chief person, and Kumaran went to prison. Now there's indirect
as did Glushenko
about that, but I think that we shouldn't underestimate the importance of Aulof, because Aulof was the responsible person in St. Petersburg for Brian. Maybe you were in Petersburg when Yuri Shutov.
Yes, I knew Yuri Shutov. I had the pleasure of meeting Mr. Shutov.
Was making the very first charges about Sobchak,
yes,
and his corruption, and then about Putin and his repressive tendencies, particularly against him. Well, it was Aulof who was in charge of the what we could say the investigation without end of Shutov, and of making sure that he was imprisoned for whatever charges. And we have a lot of these people who were bound together but conflicting with each other, playing themselves out in the Spanish indictment. The 90s is not dead amongst them. And it's why I think it's so important that Aulof was shown as being very loyal to Putin in the 90s, very loyal to Sobchak in the 90s because of the Shutov case. You have...
I mean, Shutov was public enemy number one for Putin in Sobchak at that time.
He was the first one to claim, I actually have no idea whether it's even true, that Sobchak was in touch with, if we could use that phrase, with French intelligence. And he made that claim before... years before Sobchak ended up in Paris. So
if you look,
I think to say that you've already mentioned it, but I think it's worth underlining that the privatization of the ports, and of course the fuel company, the two big issues out of which vast wealth was made and continues to be made. And kickbacks. It's not just blot. It's kickbacks. It's the system of favors, influence, but also tributes that started with the privatization of the port. The role of Ilya Traber, who's listed in this arrest warrant, for that matter, not listed in the arrest warrant, but one of the people very much involved in privatization of the port, who then went to work for Putin, was Alexei Miller, who's still in Gazprom. So, you know, these 90s decisions are very critical for understanding who this list is.
I found it also interesting to see names like Dmitry Kozak, who I knew in Petersburg in the 90s, who I would never have described him as, to use this phrase again, mobbed up. Quite the contrary, he was seen as a fairly honest and fairly liberal politician in Petersburg in the 90s. But to see him even mixed up in this was quite surprising to me. It was actually shocking when some of the initial incorrect reports reported that he was on the warrant. I was like, oh my God, that was truly shocking.
But this is the nature of the system, though, that you cannot be wholly honest,
right?
And rise. I mean, at some point, even if you are essentially honest, there comes a point where, even if you don't know that you're doing a favor that is actually for someone else, that is for someone else that might be for a gangster, this is just the nature of the system, that basically everyone is making deals. And who's going to do their due diligence?
Well, one of the things that jumped out at me, though, was when Petrov on a wiretap basically expressed happiness that Kozak was named regional development minister. That I found...
In charge of Crimea.
In charge of Crimea also. Yeah, that was interesting. Now, when Kozak was appointed to that, I always saw Kozak as Putin's Mr. Fix-It. Basically, Putin has a problem. Kozak's a workaholic. Anybody that knows Kozak, the guy works. He doesn't do this traditional Russian thing of waking up at noon. You know, the guy's up at the crack of dawn and working. And Putin values this because Putin certainly doesn't get up at the crack of dawn and start working. And Kozak was Putin's workhorse. And so but then this put this all in a whole new light. Workhorse at what? When I see a gangster like Petrov expressing on a wiretap happiness at Kozak's
I mean, I still think that he is a workhorse, and I think on the whole, of the fairly sort of senior figures within the Russian government, I think he's one of the most effective and one of the more honest. The point, I mean, the same way as, like, you know, it raised eyebrows when we saw Defense Minister Shoigu's, I think it's $12 million sort of pagoda-like mansion or whatever, when he also has a reputation as being essentially one of the cleaner ones. He is one of the cleaner ones. But the point is, in this system, you not only cannot really rise without playing the game, but just simply being in a position of power has that gravity that means that people will give you things because they want you to be in their debt and so forth.
So it's a system that is absolutely impossible to be clean in. Mark, I want to throw the same thing at you that I threw at Karen before we moved to the second part. I mean, the whole Kumadin business. Because the way I looked at Putin in the 90s when he was doing what a good operative does. He was playing both sides against the middle. Right. In the 90s, I mean, Petersburg, Tambov wasn't always top dog in Petersburg. It took a little while. There were fights with the Kazan group. There were fights between the Tambov and Malyshev before they essentially merged or formed an alliance. Putin was playing all these sides against the middle. But I always assumed, and a lot of people assumed, that Kumadin was the main guy there. Kumadin went down. Petrov stayed on top. And it seems now that Petrov had a hand in Kumadin going down. Any thoughts on all that?
Well, I mean, first of all, what it really emphasizes is that the main organized crime groupings in Russia should not be thought of as gangs in the traditional sense, with a sort of a godfather and a hierarchy. They are networks with obviously sort of sometimes closer, sometimes weaker in individual ties, but with usually a collection of people at the top of the system who often work together insofar as it's in their interests to work together, but don't necessarily share those kind of strong primal bonds of a tribe. You know, I think Kumarin sort of stayed on top for so long because he was powerful and ruthless rather than because everyone thought he was a jolly good chap. And therefore, when people had the opportunity to use resources against him and topple him, why not? But then precisely because I think, you know, Kumarin actually became a liability to himself and to Tambovskaya, because I think he didn't realize that the times were changing. He hadn't changed with them. He was still happy to be thought of as the, you know, there's this phrase, the night governor, you know, the sort of the official governor for the day and him for the night. Well, that was, you know, that was probably accurate in the 90s. It might have been cute in the early noughts. But after a certain point, particularly when it's Putin's home city, there comes a point where that becomes embarrassing, let alone whatever he might know or whatever. And it was very clear that as part of Putin's campaign for the regathering of the Russian lands, it's not just simply about bringing the key economic assets back within state control, bringing back Chechnya and you know, regional heads and so forth. It was also about ensuring that all power had to be within this kind of loose state apparatus.
Within the Ring Road.
Yeah, so you saw, I mean, because it wasn't just Kumar. I mean, it was a very similar kind of operation that was launched by, you know, police Spetsnaz from Moscow, was launched against the mayor of Makhachkala, Said the Undying. Because, again, he'd more or less set himself up as the local satrap. And that was fine for a while, but then he thought this was going to last forever. And at a certain point, as the state is busy rolling back, then it begins to think, no, time to get rid of these people who don't understand the new rules of the game.
Yeah.
Can I just make through one last point about, again, the interesting sort of Aulov point, and you know, I think sort of Karen has more or less sort of, you know, laid out really well how this all fits. But the interesting thing for me is looking at this indictment, in a way, the different functional roles that each individual has played. Because you've got Reznik in the Duma as essentially the political fixer and kind of political connection.
Right.
You've got Aulov within the MVD and then the FSKN as the enforcer, the guy who intimidates and leans on and, if necessary, does worse things to people who get in the way or become a risk. You have Sobolevsky, who's the protector, whose job is in a way to make sure that investigations don't go the way they don't want to do. And a name we haven't mentioned yet, Kristoforov, who's also there, who actually seems to be the guy who connects Petrov and Malyshev.
That was the name I didn't recognize. We were talking about this off mic last night.
And in some ways, he seems to be the ambassador between the two. Now, again, what this says, it's not actually that we have a kind of traditional gang with a kind of a consigliere and people in specific roles. I think it's more that just this is how the Russian system works. If you have an asset, you seek to monetize it, to marketize it. And you go and find people who are going to find it useful. Now, you know, it may well be that we'll discover that Sobolevsky has been doing the same kind of thing for a variety of other criminal groupings. Mm. That's okay within the etiquette of Russian organized crime. You know, it's just that everyone just looks at what they can do, and then they go out and they find buyers.
Right. I gotta wonder when a report like this is going to come out on Saltseva. It'll be pretty damn interesting.
Just add one detail about Christoforov. He was named in the trial of those held responsible for the killing of Starovoytova,
yes,
as providing the gun.
Uh-huh.
The Agran 2000. He was specifically named. So, yeah, he's a useful character.
Okay, well, on that note, we'll shift gears. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and broaden the aperture to look at the Spanish indictments in the context of other recent revelations about the Putin regime. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russian organized crime and its security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Oxford, Ohio, is Karen Dawisha, director of the Habiger Center for Russian and Post-Soviet Studies at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, and author of the highly acclaimed book Putin's Kleptocracy, Who Owns Russia? I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Результаты по делу Александра Литвиенко.
Сейчас
разглавлены панамские документы.
Испанский суд выдал международный ордер на арест 12 россиян
drip, по делу там. Drip, 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 drip. 3 months ago, a British investigation confirmed what we've always suspected about the assassination of Alexander Litvinenko. 1 month ago, the Panama Papers confirmed something we've always suspected about money laundering by Putin's cronies. And this week, a Spanish investigation has confirmed something we've always suspected about Putin's regime's ties to organized crime. It's certainly been an educational year for all of us. Now, I know you both hate the term mafia state. You're both on the record as hating that term. But, and I talked about this on the Daily Vertical this morning, no matter how much hedging and nuance and rationalization and whataboutism you throw into this mix, it's getting increasingly difficult to ignore the obvious that this regime, if not a crime syndicate masquerading as a state, is certainly a state that behaves a whole lot like a crime syndicate. What, Mark, I know, have at me.
No, I mean, I think there's two separate issues. There is, does this state often operate in the same way as a crime syndicate? And the answer is yes. But as do a lot of things, as a lot of terrorist organizations use the tactics of a crime syndicate at the same time, you know, whether it's to raise funds or whatever, as many other states have, you know, Iran and so forth. So that, you know, I think we can take as a given. The issue is, what is the ultimate motivation of the state as a structure rather than many people within it? Here is one of the sort of the, for someone like me, fascinating, but for Russians, not much fun, sort of complexities. On the one hand, Putin and so forth, for me, and I know this is an area that sort of Karen and I kind of disagree with, I think Putin is now primarily motivated by his, for want of a better word, imperial vision for Russia, this notion of bringing back Russia to its glories and his own historic mission. The overwhelming majority of the elite through whom he has to rule are just simply interested in their bank accounts, in their dachas, in their sort of personal quality of life or whatever. So I think here is the interesting sort of dilemma. It's, do we think of this as being motivated primarily by Putin's vision or the elite's vision? And the answer is, of course, a bit of both.
Are they compatible?
In the long term, no. And this is one of the reasons why I think actually ultimately, if nothing happens to Putin before that point, from health or whatever, that ultimately Putin will be toppled by the elite. Because actually, Putin's historic vision is very much at odds with their own kleptocratic interests. They don't want this current clash with the West. This is bad for business.
So I see more of a hybrid on both sides. I mean, I see, quoting James Scherer, if you say, if genealogically Putin's a product of the KGB and thus the ideology, if you will, the Great Russia ideology, sociologically, he's a product of the wild 90s. He's a product of the world that Karen wrote about in Putin's Kleptocracy, in her book about the gangster paradise of St. Petersburg. And he's a fusion of these two things. And this kind of merges with your three Russias if you eliminate the normal state. You say there's a normal state that does normal state things. There's a kleptocratic state that does mafia things. And there's an ideological state that does imperial grand design Russia things. I see in Putin a fusion of the kleptocratic and the ideological. I don't see one necessarily trumping the other. I think there's a tension there, and that at times they're complementary, but at times they're contradictory.
Well, except, I mean, my view is that if one actually looks, and this is, I think, one of the key distinctions why I would say this is not a mafia state. If it was a mafia state, one would expect state policy to be driven by what is in the interests of the criminals, the kleptocrats, and so forth. Actually, this whole challenge with the West, which is obviously leading to this Western backlash, is very bad for the kleptocrats' interests. A few of them are doing fine. You know, if you happen to be the Rotenbergs, or if you happen to be involved in cheese smuggling, you may well be laughing. But actually, for most, this is a real problem. And let's be perfectly honest. So much of the kind of activities that we're now seeing investigated seriously and actually being prosecuted, they've been around for years, decades, and we've been much, much less concerned about them.
Yeah.
It's actually, I mean, and this is something that is a depressing statement about the West. It's only when geopolitics got us excited about Russia that we really started getting concerned about Russian criminality in this respect. Mm-hmm.
Karen, your thoughts?
Well, I think if we're looking directly at Putin in all of this, Putin is, he's not a naive. He's not somebody who ever believed that the Soviet Union first and then Russia was anything but a corrupt society. He hated the Communist Party Central Committee elites who forced him to use his time in Germany and many other people to send back catalogs, magazines, shirts. I mean, the ambassador, the Soviet ambassador to East Germany and the Soviet consul in Berlin were direct suppliers to the entire Central Committee. So he hated that. On the other hand, he was getting the Red Brigades to steal car radios, car speakers for him, so car stereos for him. So, you know, he understood at a very primal level the benefits of a certain level of theft. And I think that it must be a very lonely situation for someone like Putin, whose venal greed, his venal instincts have been more than met, and yet he still feels somewhat unfulfilled. And that's where the appeal to the larger purpose comes in.
Oh, so Abraham Maslow comes into our
exactly. And so you have a situation in which competing elites. Let's just make it into a binary. But I agree, there's always shades of gray. Competing elites appeal to him for a bigger vision, a bigger role, an imperial role, a modernizing role, doing more to help poverty in Russia, so forth and so on. None of these plans are designed to do anything except to strengthen the interests of whichever group is making the argument, including their kleptocratic interests. Nobody is going in and arguing for Skolkova, who doesn't have their hand in the till for Skolkova. And that applies to every project. So you can imagine how Putin spends his day, you know, helping himself, helping one group of elites, not undermining the other group of elites too much, and understanding everybody has personalistic interests, but those interests need to be dressed up. Mm-hmm. And the arguments, I would imagine, to Putin have to be dressed up in those terms, and that whether that's Eastern Ukraine, whether that's, you know, whatever. Right. And it must be a hell of a way to spend a day.
Mm. I mean, I see, and it's interesting. You say his disdain for the materialism of the Communist Party elites during his time in Dresden. I mean, if you look at it, I mean, the late 80s had to suck for Putin. I mean, he's pushing 40. One minute he's an upwardly mobile KGB colonel and, you know, enjoying the good beer in Germany. The next minute, everything's gone. He's driving back to Leningrad with his washing machine strapped to the roof of his car. So you have that. I think the initial Putin was what Mark would call the ideological Putin. I think he believed he drank the Kool-Aid in Andropov's KGB, if you will. But I think the place Putin recovered after losing all of that was in St. Petersburg, in the wild 90s of St. Petersburg. So you have these two things. Mark, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still faintly entranced by Karen's vision that, to me, it sort of sounds like a kind of a lonely bad Santa he has become. But, I mean, going back, of course, the late 80s and the early 90s must definitely have sucked for Putin. But I'm not sure, actually, if he was ever the ideological. Mm. I can't help but feel this is, after all, the scrappy Leningrad street kid.
Who always wanted to be in the KGB.
Who always wanted to be in the biggest, toughest gang in town.
And who was entranced by Andropov, who was really entranced by Andropov. He admired Andropov.
Don't we all? But I mean, I think for him, the KGB was just the biggest, most disciplined street gang in town. Rather than, I mean, there's very little evidence that actually Marxism-Leninism was his bag. You know, no one really talks about him as being, I mean, frankly, he doesn't seem to have been a bit especially impressive KGB operative. Or
no.
But the point is, even then, no one...
If he were, he would have been in Vienna or Paris and not Dresden.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, no one who had any real contact with him talks about him in terms of ideology. So I'm not sure that he was ever about that. I think he was a statist. And exactly, I think he was looking to join the biggest, toughest gang in town.
Yeah, and then, I don't think that's inconsistent. When I say the ideological Putin, I don't mean the Marxist-Leninist Putin. I mean the great power statist Putin, because that's basically what Andropov was all about at the end of the day.
And I still think, well, no, I think Andropov was still something of a believer. But anyway, but I think the thing is, in the 1990s, there was no state. And yeah, absolutely, at that point, Putin was very, very much out for his own interests, playing whatever assets and connections he had, and he did it well. But this is, for me, one of the interesting divisions between Putin. It's actually the person who's able to play these games, but still, as Karen's have brought up, has also a degree of disdain for them. You know, he wants there to be a big state. Yeah, he wants it to be the right kind of state. And obviously he'd like it to be a state.
His
state, exactly. But I do think he genuinely is someone who actually believes that there's something wrong with the kind of primal anarchy of the 1990s, however much he personally benefited enormously from it.
Karen, last word to you before we wrap it up. If this isn't a mafia state, what the hell is it?
Well, it's a state that's ruled, I was going to say governed, but that's incorrect. It's ruled by people who were trained in the, more or less, in the 70s and 80s as Czechists. They all had to have done a course or two in Red Banner School 101 on how to move money.
Right.
And they learned it well. They had their banks in Vienna and Paris. Those bankers are now on the board of Gazprom. They're expert in the fine black arts of underground living. And when we say that there was no state in the 90s, there was no apparent state, there was a state in waiting, there was a group of people with a very wide reach who had failed in August 91. But they didn't give up hope. And Putin ultimately was their man. They had other options, I think, but they went with Putin ultimately and put their full force and full support behind him. And he has done a great job for them. So when we think about the 90s, when they think about the 90s, they think of a period when they were being formed, when they were getting their act together, when they were getting money together outside of Russia. And they started that, of course, in the 80s. And that made life very good for them. They had a back door. They had an escape hatch. But they built what we see now in Russia. And it's not totally unassailable, but I think it is pretty impressive.
Impressive in a bad way, I am assuming.
In its potential for staying power.
Okay, well, on that note, we'll wrap it up. It's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio has been Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russian organized crime and security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Oxford, Ohio, has been Karen Dawisha, director of the Havigar Center for Russian and Eastern Post-Soviet Studies at Miami University, Ohio, and author of the highly acclaimed book Putin's Kleptocracy, Who Owns Russia? Thank you both for an enlightening discussion.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our patient, brilliant, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. You can also follow Pavel on the Twitter at Pasha Butorin. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.